Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
A budget reflects your priorities, and I'm worried that K-12 education isn't the priority right now.
Educators express disappointment in Governor Dunleavy's cuts to public school funding. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 20th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a national shortage of chemotherapy drugs hits Alaska.
There has to be another way to secure a supply line for these critical medications.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed more than $200 million from a total $6.2 billion state budget yesterday. The biggest single cut was to a one-time funding increase for public schools of $175 million, which Dunleavy reduced by half. School officials and many legislators had sought the increase to help schools keep up with inflation. And heading into the next school year, district officials are now in a position of having to make cuts to their budgets, using up any savings they might have had, or both. Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks has been following the debate over increasing school funding and joins us now. James, this was a hot topic during the last legislative session, and it took really until after the deadline for legislators to agree on an amount. What are you hearing from legislators now about Dunleavy's veto?
It's going to stand, Casey. There's not enough votes right now after talking with legislators to override that veto or any of the other ones the governor has signed. If you're looking for an override, it's not coming right now. Things could change, but right now it doesn't look like there's enough votes for it.
What are legislators actually saying about this?
There's plenty of unhappiness about it, but it's mainly coming from Democrats in urban areas, some rural Democrats as well. I haven't heard much dissatisfaction from urban Republicans or rural Republicans or suburban Republicans, those from the Matsu and Kenai. And the governor has indicated that he may be willing to look at the numbers again in January once the fall enrollment figures are available. Given that idea that the legislature could come back next year and pass a supplemental budget with some more funding for schools, it seems unlikely that there'll be a override at this point.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that, but first, just have you heard anything from the governor about why he made the cut?
Very little, Casey. Unusually, the governor didn't hold a news conference, a question and answer session with reporters. As far as I can recall, and as far as others can recall, it's the first time a governor hasn't done that, going as far back as we can in statehood. I haven't found a prior instance of that. Didn't make himself available for interviews. So I've got very little to go on, except for a short message that was attached to a veto document explaining that the governor wanted to preserve more money for savings.
So, James, you mentioned that it's fairly certain that there isn't going to be an override of this veto. Remind us, where's the bar for that? I mean, what's the threshold for the legislature to override a veto? And in this case, why do you seem so sure?
Yeah, Casey, don't get me wrong. Crazy things can happen in the legislature, as I'm sure everyone listening to this knows. But Alaska has the highest threshold for a veto override in the country. It takes 3/4 of the 60 legislators to vote in favor of an override for it to happen. That's 45 of 60. And right now, there's not the numbers for that. There's more than 15 members of the legislature that think, okay, let's go ahead with this number, reassess in the spring, and maybe come back with some more funding at that point. It's not folks who are saying, no, they don't think there should be any increase. There are certainly some legislators who believe that. I don't think there's 15, but I do think that there's enough who believe in a wait and see approach and then coming back in the spring and potentially unlocking some more money then.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, we've been focused on this school funding increase and the veto to that, but there were other vetoes in the budget too. Were there other items that the governor cut that stood out to you?
That was by far the largest single item. The other cuts were smaller. There was a, for example, $3.5 million cut to Head Start grants. This is a program that provides early learning for younger kids, that kind of thing. There were a whole series of renovations to facilities at the University of Alaska that were cut out of the budget. Plenty made it through, but there were select projects that didn't. Interestingly, the governor vetoed a lot of the construction projects that were part of a session-ending deal in order to bring the legislative session to the end and pass the budget. Reporter Matt Buxton had analyzed those cuts, and he found something interesting, that the projects that were vetoed are projects that are in the districts of legislators who voted against the budget. I don't know what to make of that at this point, but I thought that was interesting as well. There were plenty of things that the legislature added that the governor did not veto. In previous years, the governor has been pretty heavy with the red pen when it comes to optional things, things that the legislature has added in after his initial budget proposal. This time around, while he did veto a fair number of things, $200 million plus in total, there were some things he left alone. For example, the legislature added $7.5 million to help boost the salaries of workers in childcare centers across the state. Childcare is a big need. There's even a crisis in terms of a shortage in childcare. The governor left that funding alone this time, letting that $7.5 million increase, something he didn't initially ask for, go through in the budget.
All right. Well, that was Alaska Beacon reporter James Brooks. You can find his work at alaskabeacon.com. James, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me again, Casey.
Alaska education leaders expressed disappointment today in Governor Dunleavy's decision to veto a one-time increase in public school funding. Yesterday's vetoes from the governor were directed at Alaska's public schools more than any other state department, totaling over $108 million in reductions to the Department of Education alone. Juneau School District Superintendent Bridget Weiss says the veto creates a revenue shortfall for the district of $750,000.
And it's very discouraging to constantly have to be begging, really, for the basic necessities to have high-functioning schools. So it is really disheartening, and I know our teachers are feeling that as well.
Officials from both the Anchorage and Mat-Su school districts say the vetoes won't impact their budget for the coming school year, but will be factored into the fiscal year 2025 budget. Mat-Su Superintendent Randy Traney says that the veto could result in cuts to programs or an increase in class sizes. He says overall, he's concerned about the message the governor's vetoes send to educators.
A budget reflects your priority, and I'm worried that K-12 education isn't the priority right now.
Besides the one-time public school funding veto, six line-item vetoes targeted public education, including the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, the Head Start Program, and school maintenance. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a teacher dedicated to passing on Yupik languages and culture retires.
For her to make sure every student in the district knew their Yupik name and were proud of it, I think that's really awesome.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers degree programs with life-friendly, flexible scheduling and course delivery options grounded in real-life experience. Alaska Pacific University offers innovative programming in nursing, counseling psychology, outdoor and environmental public health, and more. Financial aid is available. Advance your career with APU today. Learn more and apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
At least one oncology center in Alaska is starting to ration their supply of two popular chemotherapy drugs. Cisplatin and carboplatin are in short supply nationally. At Alaska Women's Cancer Care in Anchorage, they've reduced each patient's treatments by 20%. And as Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports, they're hoping they won't need to ration further.
Elizabeth Arnold was diagnosed with advanced uterine cancer a month and a half ago.
People ask me if I'm depressed, and I say, no, I'm not depressed, I'm just terrified. You know, your whole world stops.
She started her first round of chemotherapy at Providence, Alaska in Anchorage a week after her diagnosis. But after that treatment, her doctor called her to tell her about the chemotherapy drug shortages. Arnold says the stress of that piled onto the terror that she was experiencing from her diagnosis.
On top of it, to be told that the drugs that you need that are both life-saving and, in my case, life-prolonging, are in a shortage, it's just like a double whammy.
Cisplatin and carboplatin are generic drugs that can be used for several different types of cancer. They're frontline treatments for Dr. Melissa Hardesty, a gynecologic oncologist at Alaska Women's Cancer Care in Anchorage. Her clinic's drug supply, like the rest of the state, has been determined week to week. They chose to shift all their existing patients to a chemotherapy plan with 20% fewer sessions, so no one would be denied treatment, and they can't take on new patients for those treatments. Hardesty says she's worried.
Right now, as of today, the second, I have no cisplatinum in-house. So if I have a new cervix cancer patient show up, I'm essentially going to be extrapolating from other things to treat that person.
Cisplatin and carboplatin are two of the most widely used chemotherapy drugs. And while Hardesty acknowledges that drug shortages are becoming more common in recent years, she sees this shortage as different.
You know, to make a grocery analogy, we're out of milk and cheese and butter. You know, we've got the saffron flowers in the jar, and I've got some kale or something, but I'm out of the staples.
Cisplatin and carboplatin are both on the World Health Organization's list of essential cancer medications, and they're inexpensive. A bag of one of them costs around $14 to $16. That's a fraction of the price of some of the more expensive chemotherapy drugs that are still patented. Those can cost upwards of $100,000 for a round of treatment. So experts say there's little financial incentive for U.S. pharmaceutical manufacturers to produce cheaper drugs or step in when there are shortages. Cisplatin and carboplatin are in short supply because a producer in India shut down after failing an FDA inspection. According to the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, the shortage of carboplatin should start to ease in late June, cisplatin in mid-July. But there are no guarantees. Hardesty sees these production issues as a reason for the U.S. government to step up.
There has to be another way to secure a supply line for these critical medications. We have to keep a national stockpile or have some other supplement that would allow pharmaceutical manufacturers to make these agents and pay their staff a living wage.
Hardesty says she treated a patient who flew into Anchorage from Fairbanks because they couldn't get carboplatin locally that week. And one of her newly diagnosed patients returned to her country of origin to get treatment due to the shortage. But for those who can access it, Hardesty says carboplatin and cisplatin are highly effective. Elizabeth Arnold has had three rounds of chemotherapy, which include carboplatin. She says it's clear her treatments are working.
You know, there's these numbers that tell you if it's working or not. It's called CA125. It's a cancer marker. And my numbers have really dropped since after each chemo session.
Arnold is done with her current round of chemotherapy with another planned for late summer or fall. If the shortage gets worse, Providence says it will prioritize kids, people in earlier stages of cancer, and cases that would likely be cured by treatment. Because of that, Arnold isn't confident she'll have access to carboplatin when she needs it again.
I'm at the end of the list. I mean, I'm an older person and I'm advanced. And so rationing, I'm kind of at the end of the list. So that's also quite terrifying.
Arnold has another few months to wait and see if the carboplatin supplies rebound. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
The state of Alaska intends to intervene in a lawsuit that could block development of a gold mine in southwest Alaska. The Alaska Beacon reports that the state aims to support the federal government and mine developers Donlin Gold LLC and Calista Corp against a group of Alaska Native tribes that say the mine project was improperly permitted and could have ill effects on the health of residents, according to documents filed by the Alaska Department of Law on Thursday in U.S. District Court in Anchorage. Attorneys for the state wrote that the state is right to intervene because of its significant economic interest in the proposed mine project. The state stands to gain more than $1 billion in taxes and thousands of direct jobs between mine construction and operation, according to the filing. The proposed mine would be located roughly 10 miles from the salmon-bearing Kuskokwim River and could be one of the largest gold-producing mines in the world. The Eastern Aleutian community of King Cove has wanted to build a road to the all-weather airstrip in Cold Bay for decades, but different conservation groups have pushed back because the road would pass through a national wildlife sanctuary. On Thursday, the road hit yet another speed bump. KUCB's Theo Greenlee explains.
The decades-long saga over the King Cove Road continues. Lawyers for the Eastern Aleutian community are pushing back against a Thursday court decision that effectively lets the U.S. government pull out of a land swap that would allow construction of the road. But let's back up a second. Here's the context. First off, what is the King Cove Road? Well, King Cove is a community of about 750 people in the Aleutians East Borough. They're on the Alaska Peninsula, about 18 miles from Cold Bay. Cold Bay has a big all-weather airport. King Cove doesn't. And that's a big problem when it comes to things like medical evacuations. There's no hospital in either community, so they need to send folks to Anchorage for emergencies. And that's not always possible in King Cove, because their small airstrip means that planes can't fly in inclement weather. The corporation says that since 1980, there have been dozens of deaths associated with the lack of land access, either due to plane crashes or an inability to reach timely medical treatment. And they say there have been more than 200 medical evacuations from King Cove in the last decade. So the community wants to build a gravel road to Cold Bay so they have access to that all-weather airport. But the problem is that the 11-mile road would have to cut through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. The refuge was established in 1980 and is home to one of the world's largest eelgrass beds. So that led conservation groups to push against the road's construction. Okay, that's the background. Here's where we are now. The Trump administration agreed to a land swap in 2019 that would allow construction of the road. They would trade part of the federally managed land in Eisenbeck to the King Cove Corporation in exchange for another area of land that would then be preserved. The idea was that it would allow the road to cut through Eisenbeck, but it would preserve other land of the same size. Well, even though the swap was approved, when the Biden administration came in, the new Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, said they wouldn't go through with it, and they pulled out of the agreement this March. Now, that led to a lot of courtroom back and forth. King Cove's lawyer said you can't do that. The Department of the Interior said, yes, we can. And eventually, the case was brought to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Both sides argued in front of a special appointment of judges because it was too legally complicated for just one judge. And last week, the court sided with the Department of the Interior. The court said the land exchange couldn't be enforced and the deal was off. That brings us to today. The lawyers for King Cove argue that the land exchange is still valid. They say the agreement can only change if a future court rules favorably on the decision to withdraw, and that they couldn't just dismiss the motion in court. In any case, they say they will continue fighting for the road. The Aleut Corporation, which covers the entire Aleutian region, is also pushing for the road. And although the Department of the Interior pulled out of this particular land swap, it says it's looking into alternatives. Reporting from the Aleutians, I'm Theo Greenlee.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The United States military left many contaminated areas around Unalaska when they pulled out after World War II, like oil tanks and chemicals that polluted streams and soil. Now, the local tribe is teaming up with scientists from universities in Arizona, Nevada, and Alaska to address the contamination. KUCB's Sophia Stewart Rossi reports.
Okay, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. That's it.
Frank Von Hippel is collecting fish that are 1 to 2 years old in Unalaska Lake.
We got a bunch, that's fine. They're all stickleback. We can take hundreds of stickleback.
Jen Schmidt is here too, also collecting specimens.
Should I tell them they need a lot of bags?
No, we're going to not do...
They're both university scientists. Schmidt is with the University of Alaska, and Von Hippel is with the University of Arizona. And they're conducting research on fish from streams that could be environmentally polluted, which could in turn make people unhealthy if the fish are eaten regularly. The research is part of a 4-year project aimed at cleaning up contamination left behind from World War II sites near Unalaska. The Army Corps of Engineers has spent years cleaning up formerly used defense sites, or FUDs, around the island, and they're still working on cleaning up dozens of sites that are left behind. FUDs may have persistent organic pollutants and toxic metals like mercury and arsenic. They're all harmful, especially if consumed at high levels. The Kowalungan Tribe of Unalaska is also involved in the cleanup efforts. They've teamed up with the National Science Foundation and university scientists who are collecting fish and soil samples in areas that community members use for subsistence fish and berries, like around Morris Cove, Humpy Cove, and Summer Bay Lake. Elise Contreras is the Environmental Remediation Manager for the Q Tribe. She says this data collection could lead to changes of livelihood.
We want people to be empowered to participate in their subsistence activities and to be able to do whatever recreation and feel safe and comfortable eating, fishing, hunting in these areas without concern of contaminants from the past.
Von Hippel presented his work to Unalaskans a couple times throughout his week-long stay on the island. He says this research project in Unalaska can be a model for communities who are currently dealing with FUD sites contaminating subsistence foods.
It's important that it's a community-engaged project, and as a community-engaged project, the community is guiding where the sampling should take place and what should be done about any problems that are encountered during the sampling.
Collected soils and fish were packaged at the tribe's warehouse and flown with the scientists back to their labs in Anchorage, Nevada, and Arizona. Once the results are finalized, they'll be shared with the tribe and presented to the community. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
A longtime Southwest Region School District educator from Aleknagik has dedicated decades to teaching Yupik language and culture. Ahonuk Esther Ilutsik retired last month. As KDLG's Christina McDermott reports, the work has educated and uplifted students throughout the region.
When Ahonuk Esther Ilutsik began working as the Southwest Region School District's Yupik Studies Director 12 years ago, she helped develop the district's entire curriculum for Indigenous culture and language. She worked alongside Yucatan language instructors to create lessons on Yupik values in the classroom for the entire district.
We have respect for our land and its resources. So each of the native and non-native teachers focus on that value just for a few minutes. How do we respect our land?
Ilutsik and the director's other language instructors made language lessons that teach through active storytelling called total physical response storytelling. Using traditional stories, they developed materials to teach parents about the lessons and even published a children's book. They also used students' Yupik names. Lutzik says that helps students know who they are within a Yupik context.
I know that when I first went out, I'd ask the students what their Yupik names were, and they wouldn't know. But now they say it with pride that my Yupik name is, and it gives them a sense of identity.
Lutzik's daughter, Atkuk, says she saw the impact of her mother's work at Elektnicik's graduation ceremony last month, where each student's Yupik name was displayed.
You know, I've worked as a teacher in the past with Native students that didn't have that and were wanting that, wanting a Native name and didn't grow up with one and feeling that void. So for her to make sure every student in the district knew their Yupik name and were proud of it, I think that's really awesome.
Lutzik has a long history in education. She's worked as a teacher, principal, and professor. She's also authored and edited several books in Yuktun and English that captured elders' stories, memories, and traditional knowledge. Atkuk remembers Lutzik, her mother, teaching in her classroom.
She made sure that she actually came into the classroom, into my elementary school classroom, and shared with all the students our knowledge from the region, making sure song and dance were being taught, stories, traditional activities, all of that.
Atkuk says her mother fostered her own love for traditional song and dance. At a recent retirement party for Lutzik, Atkuk led the Dillingham High School dance group in a performance. Lutzik says going forward, she hopes to hear more people speaking Yuktun. She says the program needs funding and hopes the parent handbook will encourage parents to participate, especially those who did not have the opportunity to grow up learning about their language or culture.
And that's why we put this thing together, to see if the parents might be interested in learning the language and maybe putting classes together and having different, this is what your child is learning this week. If you want to help them, this is what you do. And then learn at the same time.
Lutzik's classroom legacy means that her successors have a complete curriculum to continue teaching Yuktun and Yupik culture. At her retirement party last month, she celebrated with a room full of colleagues, family, and friends. In Dillingham, I'm Christina McDermott.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Theo Greenlee and Sophia Stewart Rossi in Unalaska, and Christina McDermott in Dillingham. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
That eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.